The language you are hearing in this song is Miskito. That's a native language spoken in the northeast corner of Nicaragua and the southeast corner of Honduras. If you understand the words, you make up a very small portion of our global population. And yet, a lecturer in KU's Department of Latin American and Caribbean Studies wrote and starred in an operetta in Miskito, based on her own true life story. That's what this song is from. She also hosts a thrice weekly radio show in Miskito with a huge following among the Miskito people. So our question today is, how did this happen? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm happy to welcome Laura Hobson-Herlihy to the show. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
Good. This music is awesome. I love it. Can you tell me about the rhythm?
Well, I don't really write the music. I write the lyrics. So the musicians there produce it and write the songs. So it's a combination, I think, of calypso and more Latin music.
I would totally go to this operetta.
Oh, thank you.
It's called Green Man, Blue Woman. What is that title reference?
Well, it sounds a lot better in Miskito. Like a lot of poetry, it doesn't translate very well.
What is the title in Miskito?
Wake na sangni, maiden blue.
And that's with your southern accent.
I am from New Orleans, so I have a strange mix of New Orleans accent over my Miskito, yes.
So the badly translated title from your standpoint, Green Man, Blue Woman, though, what does it mean and what is it about?
Well, Wake na sangni, or Green Man, is he's like the king down there. He's everything. He's a cross between the president, the pope, and Elvis Presley.
And is this the real character you're basing him on, or is this a fictional?
He's the real character. His name is Brooklyn Rivera, and he's been the leader of the Miskito people since probably 1978. He started as a college student and became their leader during the war years of the 80s, during the Sandinista Revolution, and he was a contra-military leader, a general.
Is that in the U.S.-backed contra movement?
Yes, it is. And a lot of people think that we used these contra Indians against the Sandinistas, but on the Caribbean coast, which is about one-fourth of the Contras, and they are the only successful counter-revolutionaries against the Sandinistas, they were successful, and they used us to get half the country for their politically autonomous homeland. So they got something good out of it. And
do I understand correctly that there was existing anti-Spanish sentiment among the Miskito people and that was transformed into a political force? But yeah, it sounds like there was maybe a shared interest there.
Yeah, they have anti-Spanish ideologies, Anglo affinities, and that goes back to the colonial era. They were a British protectorate, and they were never conquered by the Spanish. So they have always been ready for outside support, and especially in alliance with the gringos, to fight against the Spanish speakers.
And so Brooklyn Rivera is Green Man in your musical, but he's someone who you personally know.
Right, and he's green because, you know, that's the color of his indigenous organization, the Yatama organization. And so in Miskito, when people say, let's go to Yatama headquarters, they say, let's go to the greenhouse, Utla Sangni. And so he's also Waikna Sangni. And it's also supposed to invoke a military color.
I want to get back into some of these politics and his character. But before I do, the title, again, not necessarily well translated, is Green Man, Blue Woman. Who is Blue Woman?
Oh, I'm Blue Woman because I travel with the leader. I'm like his personal anthropologist, and he put a love potion on me, and that's why I write positively about him. And
is this real? He really put a love potion on you?
Well, he uses potions all the time. It's part of their culture down there. And I'm from New Orleans, so my receptors are turned on to this because I grew up with voodoo and hoodoo. And it's a lot of the same things that they use down there. And, you know, he travels with his shaman a lot, especially before elections. And the reason he stayed in power that long, people say, is because his medicine is so strong, his love magic. So he probably put some love magic on me, as he would any outsider, to write positively about him and to support his organization.
The reason I keep asking if things are real is not because I can't imagine that they would be, but because I do understand that there's some fictionalization in your writing, in this play, this musical. And so I want to make sure that I'm getting the distinctions between where fact ends and fiction begins.
Well, I don't really know myself, because when I'm there, it's such a different reality. And when you're speaking Miskito, things make sense that don't make sense in English. So do you want to know why I'm the blue woman?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Well, a rival political faction kidnaps me and takes me to their own shaman to cut the power that the green man's potion has on me, because they don't want me supporting him and Yatima, because they have their own organization. They'd like my help, too. So the shaman bathes me in a counteractive remedy, a potion, a contra, and that potion is blue. Right. And it smells like garlic and lime. And it's the typical counteractive remedy there that is the color blue. And so after I bathe in it, my skin turns blue, my heart turns blue, my face turns blue, and I turn into the blue woman.
I suppose it's pointless for me to ask you where fact and fiction commingle on that one.
Well, it really happened. The kidnapping, though, wasn't threatening like you think of it here.
I do think of kidnappings as threatening, yes.
Yeah, it wasn't like that, actually. But we were in the village of Miguel Beacon. And I had my study abroad students there from KU. And we were all going to a shaman. And they were going just to get a good luck potion on them. And then our guide, who happens to be from the other faction, he slips some money to the shaman on the side to give me a special potion. So that's the way that happened.
All right. I think we're going to need to back way up and get the whole story. Tell us, first of all, about the language of Miskito and how you came to speak it.
Well, I followed a boy to the rainforest. My husband, Peter Herlihy, who's a geography professor at KU. And for the 6 months right after we were married, we went to a small village in Honduras called Curi. And that had 22 huts, no running water, no electricity. And he traveled a lot with the men because he does his geography thing. And I stayed in the village with the women and the children and learned the language.
Was it hard to learn?
You know, there are a lot of English and Spanish loan words. And because of the history with the British, there's, I think it's a more similar language to English. So English speakers can learn Miskito easier than Spanish speakers.
And you are an anthropologist, so I think it would be reasonable to ask you to also explain who are the Miskito culturally and politically.
Well, they are a post-colonial group, which means that they really didn't exist until the colonial era at contact.
And wait, what do you mean they didn't exist?
Well, one Indian group, probably Sumu-speaking people, mixed with escaped blacks and also pirates, British people, and other northern Europeans. And they intermarried, and the women passed down the language. So they're a very mixed group, and they define themselves mostly by their language.
And they're defined by a cultural encounter, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So you are living among the Miskito people in huts in Honduras while your husband travels. And how does that go? How do you go from that to traveling through the rainforest with the Miskito political leader, Brooklyn Rivera?
Well, years later, after I had children, my mother from New Orleans, she said that I was forbidden to go back into the hut with my children, into the small village, that I needed to be somewhere with infrastructure. And so hospitals and airports and telephones. So I crossed over to the big city of Bilwi, or Puerto Cabezas, Nicaragua. And there, I pretty much made that my second home since then.
What year are we talking about?
Well, I had a Fulbright to teach in the Indigenous University in 2004. So I started working in Bilwi in 2004. And that's like the New York City of the rainforest.
The New York City of the rainforest. Can you help me understand this place a little more clearly? Because New York City and the rainforest seem a little mutually exclusive to me.
Well, I was like a small town girl coming from 22 huts, no electricity, no running water. And then I get to Bilwi, and it's about 50,000 people, two indigenous universities, lots of radio stations, TV in Miskito. You can use your credit card and speak Miskito at the same time. I could buy wine in the grocery stores. I was just in heaven because my, you know, as you get older, of course, I needed more electricity for my blow dryer, et cetera. So I was happy to be still in Miskito popular culture, listening to Miskito on the airwaves, which I never had listened to before in Honduras, and being comfortable.
I'm still not totally at the point yet where I understand how it is that you're traveling through the rainforest with Brooklyn Rivera.
Well, I had been listening to everyone talk about this guy, right? They idolize him, and he is like Elvis, where, you know, he's the name on everyone's lips. They always talk about where he is, and I had never even seen him. And at one music festival, I finally saw him, and he was sitting on a throne with palm leaves shrouding him, his daughter Tinaniska, which means hummingbird, at his side, and I wanted to meet him. So I asked a few people in the crowd, and they introduced me to some of his handlers. And as he exited, they brought me to him, and I spoke to him in Miskito, and he was impressed that I could speak Miskito. And so he immediately handed me his cup of misla, which is fermented, I guess like a fermented intoxicant. They use at ritual occasions, and gave me some to drink. So we shared that and we became friends.
All right. And so the musical / operetta you've written and that you star in, right?
Well, it hasn't been staged yet as a production. Right now, it's just an original score. And we gave a concert on Easter Sunday. 5,000 people came. And
in Nicaragua.
Yes. On the beach of Puerto Cabezas, Bilwi, New York City. And that is the farthest that we've gotten it developed so far.
But they've invited you back to perform it again in June, so that's a good sign.
Yes, and we're going to take it on the road and take it up to smaller villages that are big fans of the radio show.
So the radio show, that is the other thing I want to ask you about. You host a radio show in Miskito that has a Miskito following. What's the deal with that?
Well, I call in from the States when I'm not there. I have another host. I guess I'm a co-host. And he does the show when I'm not there. I call up and then he puts the cell phone up to the microphone. And then I'm able to speak to the crowd and explain the songs.
So do you ever feel sheepish about being a white woman, English speaker from the United States, an academic who's become this resounding voice in Miskito in this pop culture landscape, whereas your audience is, forgive me for the terminology, but like the real deal?
Well, I think there's a difference between appreciating a culture and I guess most people would say that, you know, I shouldn't co-opt this culture, appropriate culture, but I appreciate it. I've spent my whole life with them. Over 25 years learning their language, and I really love them, and I think people can tell that.
As far as when you say people can tell that, you're talking about the people there.
Yes, and they get a kick out of it that a gringa, a U.S. Woman, is speaking their language. They love it, and again, they have such historic ties with the British and with the U.S. through the banana companies and the logging companies. United Fruit Company worked there. And for them, those were good, the good days.
So does your does your radio show and does this operetta, do they take a political position at all?
No, but they do help, I guess, the name of Brooklyn Rivera, because he's sort of known as a military guy. And so this gives him a softer, it sort of softens him. And he was down for a while, and he was expelled from the National Assembly by the dictator, Daniel Ortega, and the Sandinista regime. And they accused him of selling Indian lands, of being a traitor, of inciting violence. And my show came on while he was kicked out of office, basically. And he ran again in November during the general elections, a day before our elections here, and he won. And people think that the show helped him because it sort of helped soften him.
Was that, did you soften him because of the person you got to know?
Well, yeah. And I definitely think that maybe his Achilles heel is his personal life, because he's an unmarried male and he has a lot of kids from different women, but no one really knows about his personal life. So it's unusual for a man of his age to be unmarried. And so I sort of fictionalized this relationship and broadcast it. And so people kind of now treat me like the first lady.
Is that uncomfortable for you? I mean, again, because as an academic, I know academics and journalists aren't the same thing, but in journalism, if you're trying to document something, you usually don't want to also be influencing the outcome of the thing you're documenting, just in your presence and how you conduct yourself.
Yeah, I kind of feel like the Hunter S. Thompson of anthropology, because it's a little bit like gonzo anthropology. So I go make the story happen and then I write about it.
Well, let's go out on a little more music from Green Man, Blue Woman. What's going on in this scene? I mean, I've listened to the song, but I don't understand one bit of Miskito.
Well, I bet you can listen to some of the words and understand. It's talking about the United Nations in New York, in the real New York. And so you can hear the term New York Pleskara in the song. And another line is Injin Ailal Barakan, Injin for Injin. There are a lot of Indians there. So we're at the Permanent Forum for Indigenous Issues at the United Nations. And it's talking about the different groups that are at the UN, all the indigenous people fighting for their rights, wearing their indigenous garb, and the variety of peoples that are there and how moving the experience was.
What character is singing this?
Well, it's in the third person, and this is actually a singer named Tony Miller from Honduras. He was a little boy. I knew him when he was just 7 or 8 years old, and now he's in Bill Wee, and he's about 30, I guess. And he's singing in the third person about the blue woman and the green man.
So he's almost like a narrator in this scene.
Uh-huh. And so he's singing about the two of them at the United Nations, where they work together, and she becomes an indigenous activist there.
Do your students at KU know about this other life you have?
Well, I just finished teaching Miskito this semester, and so they actually translated some of the songs together with me, so they do know.
Laura Hobson-Herlihy with us from KU's Department of Caribbean and Latin American Studies. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Green Man, Blue Woman tells a fictionalized version of Laura's story in the language of Miskito. Up next, how a Kansas City woman transforms Japanese textiles. I'm Gina Kaufman. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now I'm joined by Elizabeth Wilson, the force behind Asiatica, a longtime Kansas City store where Japanese textiles are adapted and transformed into garments for fashionably artsy Americans. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gina.
So that was kind of a quick and dirty explanation of what you do, but it's a fairly nuanced process with a whole story behind it. So why don't you give us the slightly longer version of what it is you do at Asiatica?
we try to show Kansas City the beauty of Japan through its products. Furniture, ceramics, baskets, oddities that I find, textiles, whatever I can find that I find appealing and I bring back from Japan.
So some of the items are sold as they are, but with the clothing, that really seems to be a transformative kind of collaboration between your staff and people who originally made these textiles in Japan.
Well, most of the people who originally made the textiles that we use for the clothing, at least among the vintage kimono, are long gone. But we literally are transforming a product from one society to another. So when I started Asiatica 40 years ago, I would go to Japan to buy things that I thought Americans had, particularly in Kansas City, had never seen before and that they might like. And among the things that I bought were old kimono, because they were very beautiful and they were very inexpensive. They were literally thrown away clothes, used clothes. And after a few years, I realized that the kimono had to be made into something, because Americans don't usually go around wearing kimono except from the bathtub to the, anyway, bathware or tourist items. And I began with a friend of mine, Fifi White, to transform the kimono fabric into clothing.
What made you want to do that? What made you think there's this thing in Japan that fills this very specific kind of cultural role, has this history behind it, and I'd like to make it into this other thing in my culture?
Well, it didn't really start out that way. It seemed like a good idea to buy a very inexpensive resource that was available in quite large quantities among maybe, I can't even describe how few of the used kimono that we found, we really found worthy of even shipping back home. So they started to pile up as kimono. And Fifi said at one point, why don't we make clothes? Somebody else said, why don't you make pillows? Well, I being the skeptic, said, clothes? Oh, my goodness, Americans have all different sizes and shapes. And how do you make clothes that fit everybody? Well, it coincided with the beginnings of ise miyake and sort of clothes shaped by fabric rather than by bodies. So when we first started, that's sort of the thing we did. We made one size, and we made interesting shapes, but they weren't body-conforming shapes.
Can you explain that a little bit more? Clothing shaped more by fabric than by bodies?
Well, a kimono is a modular garment. It's made of 12-inch wide fabric. It's about 10.5 meters in a kimono, or 10 and a half yards, we can say. Meters and yards are more or less equivalent. And men, women, and children, old and young, fashionable and unfashionable, before the war more than after the war, all wore kimono.
Which war?
Which are garments that are... which war? Oh, I see. In my generation, we refer to the war as the Second World War. And those garments are made out of the same length of fabric, and they're not particularly tailored. So it's easily recyclable. And while we didn't have a recycling psychology, it seemed totally logical to dismember, so to speak, the kimono and recover the yardage edge to edge. And it made a perfect vehicle to make one garment.
And so what year are we talking about when this particular...
brilliant idea hit? It was probably about 1979 or 80.
So tell me more about your relationship with Japan. In 1979 or 80, the kinds of conversations people would have had in this country about Asian cultures, about Asian countries, Asian textiles, it seems like the mainstream conversation about that would have been very different from what it is now. And I'm curious about, at that point in 1979, what was your relationship with Japan? When did you first start going there?
I first went in 1969 as a graduate student on my way to study Chinese art history in Taiwan. And I lived in Japan in 1972 for 8 months. And I was always wanting to buy the things that I knew about. And I knew a lot about Japanese art, but the things that I really, really wanted were in museums, including the Nelson and including Chinese art as well. So I made a decision in about 1976 to bring some of these objects that were totally unfamiliar, practical, utilitarian, some contemporary, some slightly older Japanese objects to Kansas City and open a store. I thought everybody would come running and say, oh, wow, this is great. I saw things like this at the Nelson. I've always been wanting to buy these things.
Why did you want to buy them? Was it that you had a particular...
I like buying things.
Did you have a particular attraction to some of these objects?
All of them.
Tell me about...
I only buy what I like.
Tell me a memorable object from those early days when you were still just pining to do this.
Well, when I lived there, I furnished my apartment with blue and white cotton kimono that I wrapped around pillows. I hung on the wall. I used as table decoration. And I liked lacquer bowls and pottery and paper and shopping bags and all the things that I could afford to buy on a $2,000 a year fellowship.
When you were telling me about paper, can you tell us more? What about the paper?
Well, Japanese are great designers. They can design anything. Some people might be familiar with architecture, with textiles, with ceramics. They can apply decoration in a most modern-looking way to virtually any surface. And the aesthetic point of view transfers from one medium to another.
Did you experience these objects differently in Japan than you experienced them once you started bringing them home to the United States? Or did the objects sort of preserve some inherent character or quality no matter where you were living with them? Just, yeah, how do you think that you experienced these objects in Japan in maybe a different way than someone encountering them for the first time here?
Well, I think if someone's visual and they go to Japan, they want all of it. At least all the beautiful things. They want the gardens. They want the architecture. They want just the general atmosphere of tidy and energetic beauty that you find in small corners and even in some larger parts of Japan. It's by no means everywhere. And so I wanted to take it home. Well, first fantasy was moving a Japanese farmhouse to Platte County, Missouri. Well, turned out to be rather an impractical idea. What?
Tell me about that farmhouse that you wanted to move.
A friend had moved some farmhouses were being neglected because Japanese really don't like old things. They're just like Americans. They want that old Victorian house, that old Japanese farmhouse. It's expensive to maintain. It leaks. It's cold. It's too hot. We can't get the air conditioning in it, etc. So there were wonderful Japanese farmhouses going for sale, and a friend of mine in Kamakura bought a couple of them and erected them on a site on top of a hill in Kamakura, and that I thought was just absolutely the most beautiful way to live.
Why had he done that?
Saving the houses and also appreciating their aesthetics, and installing inside them all his Japanese art collection.
And so you wanted to move a Japanese farmhouse to Missouri?
It was
Missouri?
A fleeting fantasy.
And I guess, so from here, I mean, my understanding is that at Asiatica, there's a whole team of textile artists, of fiber artists who customize clothing using Japanese textiles. Can you explain that process a little bit more?
Well, we're a small company. We've been in existence for 40 years. And once the clothing became the most economically viable part of what we did, we made more and more. And we have now a company of 10 people who cut. Well, we start with buying of fabrics, and our fabrics supply is not limited to vintage kimono, which are dwindling, but also include artisanal Japanese contemporary fabrics with avant-garde kinds of textiles being used. They include Italian fabrics. And we have 10 of us, starting with me, who buys the fabric for the most part, pattern maker, several very talented women who cut the clothes, either for ready-to-wear or to order. We have seamstresses. We have somebody who finishes the clothes. We have someone who takes care of all our office needs, including fixing plumbing problems and all kinds of personnel issues. So we are a very tight-knit team of 10.
One of the sort of words that's on everyone's lips nowadays is appropriation. There's a lot of concern in the general public, I would say, about who has ownership of a cultural idea or a cultural practice. And the kimono would be seen, I guess, as a very traditional Japanese thing. I wonder if appropriation is a word that comes up when people talk to you about what you do, or if it's something that you think about or worry about at all.
I do not worry in the slightest. There was a dispute in the Boston Museum because they put out a kimono for somebody to try on to further cement them to an image of Manet's image of a woman in kimono. And there was a huge political eruption because they accused the museum of cultural misappropriation. Well, all they needed to do to fight that argument was to put up some pictures of Japanese in blue jeans. I mean, cultural appropriation is universal. Fire, gold, Roman Empire, every culture appropriates from other cultures, transforms it, and it enriches the world. I don't think any culture needs to be so insecure that they would be insulted by somebody wearing a kimono.
Do you think, have you shared in among your contacts in Japan, I'm guessing that people have seen the end result of your work. What are those conversations?
They're all doing
like?
The same thing. In the beginning, 40 years ago, they thought it was very strange. You know, what are you going to do with these? Because adaptive reuse was not comfortable in Japan. It's a very traditional society, and they see everything with a very specific function. And that I would swoop in and buy something that was appropriate for a child and transform it into a blouse for a 50-year-old woman, they thought was pretty amusing. And Fifi White and I, who started this clothing project, were called pioneers of kimono reform. And we were even in a book, in a magazine published in Japan. Now, almost all the secondhand kimono dealers are making clothes for their customers out of old kimono fabric.
So this is kind of what people do with old kimono fabric?
One of the things, yes. They also make little dolls and little bags and various other things using these beautiful textiles.
This question about appropriation, I mean, I don't want to get too hung up on it, but it's interesting because part of the concern about it from the standpoint of a Western country, I think, is that it has to do with power. And so who has kind of the opportunity to do what with someone else's story, with someone else's cultural trappings that might have, I don't know, unfair stereotypes associated with them, oversimplified stereotypes associated with them. And so I guess I totally appreciate what you're saying, that people in Japan wear blue jeans. And I've been to Japan and I've seen T-shirts that incorporate the English language into them.
And Chanel suits. And Hermes handbags.
And it's a very, there are cosmopolitan cities that show signs of all sorts of cultural influences. But does the power thing change how you view appropriation maybe more generally or no?
Not to me. I really reject the whole idea of these political aspects of and really appreciating other people's cultures. And Japan, of all countries, isn't. Their culture is made up of influences from China, from Central Asia, from Southeast Asia, from Korea, not to mention blue jeans, Hermes handbags, and French clothing. And who knows where these influences come from? That's what makes world culture so crucial.
It is interesting because I think, I mean, I wonder if part of what happens is that when we talk about cultures other than our own and we think about things like appropriation, maybe we're also forgetting that, I don't know, that no culture lives in a time warp like that.
Maybe North Korea. But I just read an article about the fact that we should never put Asian salad on a menu. It was in the New York Times. I was just incredulous. Are people so insensitive to the fact that we should be opening up to the world rather than closing down? My whole business really is about, it's really somewhat, one can look at it as an educational institution where our Japanese textile collection is vast And we have people coming all the time, students and textile makers and craftspeople from all over the world who just love what we do and are astonished that it's happening in Kansas City.
Do you, would you say that in the last 40 years that you've been in business, do customers walk through your door with a different kind of education or information or understanding of Japan, of the culture that is providing sort of the basis for these objects?
I would say that 50% of our customers are not even aware that we're using Japanese textiles at all.
Really?
They just want to buy a beautiful jacket.
What do they make of the name?
Not much. I think people don't understand the name. If they didn't have Latin in high school like I did, the name Asiatica is sort of a mystery. And we used it 40 years ago because it means Asian things. And it seemed self-explanatory. But I don't think most people have any clue anymore. They have we have very educated customers, and I suppose they understand the meaning of the word. But to a lot of people, I have to spell it out because even the first four letters are not meaningful.
Is there something new that you're hoping to do going into the future?
Well, I want to spread the word of, I want to encourage people to be curious about the world, to see new things, to open themselves up, not close their perspective down. And I want to encourage the types of craftspeople that we've trained and that we employ to continue work successfully.
What, do you have a story of an object that you'd be willing to leave us with, like a specific object from your 40 years of doing this that you encountered that means something to you?
There are way too many. My interests are really broad across many, many areas of art. I buy whatever I like whenever I find it, and I wait for it to find a new home.
Elizabeth Wilson of Asiatica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Up next on KCUR Central Standard, we'll revisit a comment that drew lots of questions from our listeners during a show on new gun laws in Kansas and how they'll affect state universities. I'm Gina Kaufman. We did a show recently on KCUR Central Standard on the impact new concealed carry laws will have on college campuses in Kansas. Former Kansas legislator John Rubin helped craft one of the laws in question. He came on the show and made some comments that our listeners asked us to clarify. Here's exactly what he said about concealed carry that got your attention.
The right to get a concealed carry permit, to conceal carry in the state of Kansas, wherever it is allowed, is only after a person goes through a background check and in-depth substantive training on the use of firearms and safety measures with regard to the use of firearms. That is why I supported the concealed carry law, because I would like individuals, if there are not adequate security measures in place in any public building in the state of Kansas, to be able to defend themselves and other innocent people from those who are breaking the law and attempt to do harm in those places by having a properly trained person who has gone through a background check, a properly trained person with a firearm and knows how to use it to protect them.
So people got really upset about that. Comments flooded in telling us that students actually won't need any special training to permit or permit to bring a gun on campus. Peter Hancock is a state house and political reporter for the Lawrence Journal World. And Peter, who's right? As of July 1st, when the new law goes into effect, do you need a permit to carry a concealed handgun on campus?
The state of Kansas does not require permits anymore. I think Mr. Rubin is referring to the original concealed carry law, which initially passed in 2006, allowed people to carry concealed weapons if they went through training, if they obtained a permit and went through the required training. It was in 2013 that the state greatly expanded the list of places where you could carry concealed handguns. To include, starting on July 1st, public college and university campuses and most government-owned buildings other than K-12 schools. That was in 2013. In 2015, 2 years later, they passed what's called a constitutional carry law, and that's the term applied by people who take a very purist view of the Second Amendment, and they argue that you should not be required to get the government's permission to exercise your constitutional right to carry handguns. So under that 2015 law, you are not required to obtain permits or to undergo training. The state does still offer permits primarily for people who want to carry their weapons when they travel to other states where permits are required, and they recognize permits from other states. But nevertheless, to carry a concealed weapon in Kansas, you're not required to undergo training or obtain a permit.
What do you think is the source of confusion here? Do you think that he was talking about the previous law?
That, you know, I couldn't say without talking to Mr. Rubin himself. I know that he was a supporter of the 2013 law that expanded the right to carry concealed firearms in publicly owned buildings. And I know that he was a supporter of the constitutional carry bill that passed 2 years ago. He is listed as a yes vote in the House Journal when they took the vote on that, I want to say March 25th of 2015. So now, in fairness, I will say oftentimes legislators will vote yes on a bill even though it contains provisions they don't like, because it contains other provisions that they do like. The constitutional carry bill, though, the specific intent of it was to remove the requirement that people undergo training and obtain a permit in order to exercise their right to carry a firearm.
We did ask John Rubin if he would clarify his comments for us, but he didn't respond to those requests. So here's something else he said that might help, and it has to do with the distinction he makes between concealed carry and open carry. Before we play that clip, can you explain to me, is there one law that's concealed carry and one law that's open carry that we can understand in a sort of clear way? Are they?
Well, to my knowledge, no, there is not a separate open carry provision. Within the constitutional carry bill, this was Senate Bill 45 back in 2015, there is a reference to open carrying. I think it says the availability of licenses to carry concealed handguns under this act shall not be construed to impose a general prohibition on the carrying of handguns without such a license.
Wait, can you translate that into regular English? Because I got a little lost in the shall nots and so forth.
Okay. The mere fact that the state offers permits does not mean that you're required to get one. And it goes on to say, whether carried openly or concealed, or loaded or unloaded. So within the text of that bill, it references the right to open carry. So that's in there.
Well, let's hear exactly what John Rubin said and see if there's something that can help us understand the context for some of his comments.
If there's an area where the professor and I might find some level of agreement, it's on open carry. I was not a co-sponsor or an open advocate of the open carry law that was recently passed in Kansas. Now, the distinction I would see there is, and what I am, again, want to emphasize to your listeners, is that I believe that the idea of someone who has not gone through a background check and who has not been properly trained in the use of firearms could present some of the issues and the questions that the professor alluded to and you have on college campuses. That's why what I support is the concealed carry law on college campuses, not necessarily open carry, and that's an important distinction.
Peter Hancock, what do you make of that?
I am at a loss of what to make of that. Now, I will say there was yet another bill in 2014. It was House Bill 2578, which passed by a margin of 102-19, that also references open carry. And there was a new provision added to the what's called the Personal and Family Protection Act. That's basically the concealed carry law. That makes it a violation to carry an unconcealed firearm into a building where it's conspicuously posted that you're not allowed to bring in firearms. Those are those ubiquitous no gun signs that you see on the doors of private businesses all around. So it is a violation to carry an unconcealed firearm into a building that is posted not to allow it. However, you know, you go back to the bill that passed in 2015, the constitutional carry bill. Clearly, it does not require training, and you know, it makes some reference to open carry as well.
So, but this, the idea that there might be something in this distinction between open carry and concealed carry that would explain the other distinction between a requirement for training and a lack of those kinds of requirements, there's no relationship there, just to be clear.
I don't believe there is, no.
So going forward, I mean, can you tell us more about what the conversation is looking like? July 1st is approaching pretty quickly. What are you hearing in your reporting from different sides on this?
In the Kansas Senate, they just reported out a bill out of the Ways and Means Committee yesterday that would permanently extend the exemption for hospitals, clinics, things of that sort, KU Hospital, Osawatomie State Hospital.
So does that mean it's not looking like guns will be permitted in Kansas state-run hospitals?
Well, there is a bill that would extend the exemption. Whether or not it can pass both chambers, it could be fairly close. Whether or not Governor Brownback would sign it, we don't know. We do know that the cost of securing the four state hospitals, the only way the buildings can prohibit guns is if they have adequate security that prevents anybody from bringing in a gun. And the cost of securing those two hospitals, I think there's an upfront cost of maybe about several million dollars, and then ongoing costs to employ armed security guards at the public entrance points. That has become contentious in budget negotiations because the state doesn't have. It's like $25 million was the initial estimate. State doesn't have that much money, and if it spends $25 million at Osawatomie State Hospital or the other hospitals, they don't want to do it for security. They have other issues to take care of. So that's kind of, you know, the budgetary concern. There had also been concerns raised by community mental health centers. The city of Lawrence, for example, owns a hospital and a community mental health center. Several other cities do as well. So they've raised a lot of concern. But it's looking at this point like there is not enough support in the legislature to permanently exempt universities and community colleges.
Which means that what they're calling campus carry would be most likely expected to go into effect as written on July 1st.
At this point, that seems to be the direction that the legislature is going.
Peter Hancock joining us from the Lawrence Journal World. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Gina.
You can listen back to all of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, one of our reporters has spent the entire school year camped out in the classrooms of Hickman Mills, where she's been trying to understand why so many students start in a classroom at the beginning of the year and then aren't there anymore come springtime, and what the implications are for the educational experience all the students receive. We'll dive into the big questions from her Musical Chairs series tomorrow at 10. Join us. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.